times to think in between two.
You need to process.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So how did you come to write Mermaids?
How I came to write Mermaids by Richard Van Camp. As told to Harmit on October
6th, 2004. In Vancouver, in the wooden Dutch shoe?
Yeah, the Dutch wooden shoe.
Dutch wooden shoe.
On Canby.
Okay. And 16.
Yes, exactly. So how I wrote Mermaids is a very curious tale. Mm-hmm. And when I was at the University of Victoria, I went home for the summer to work and make money so that I could go back to my fourth year at the University of Victoria. This must have been around 1996.
Okay.
And a friend of mine named Junior picked me up at the airport mm-hmm. in Fort Smith and drove me back towards town. And I assumed that he would drop me off at my family's log house.
Mm-hmm.
What I didn't realize was that we just kept driving right past town. And I said, what are you doing? Where mm-hmm. my dad's going to cook for us, mm-hmm. and then I've got to haul wood. You know, mm-hmm. I know exactly mm-hmm. what happens when I get home. It's get to work. I'll feed you, but you've got mm-hmm. six cords of wood that you've got to haul and chop mm-hmm. and all that good stuff. And so he said, just wait, I want to show you something. So we drove past town to a little community called Fort Fitzgerald. And that right now is a reserve. When I was growing up, that was not a reserve. And I thought, well, I wonder what's going on out at Fort Fitz. Perhaps there was a community picnic, or there were flying kites, or they were having a back to the land celebration mm-hmm. or a feast. So I trusted Junior because I grew up with mm-hmm. him my whole life. And as we came around the corner, I mean, in those days, there were probably around 10 families that live out there very quietly on the land, mm-hmm. very private people. When I came around the corner in Junior's car, there were trucks and cars parked everywhere on the side of the road. And I thought, oh good, this is going to be fun, you mm-hmm. know, there's going to be something for a celebration, maybe my family's already out here.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got there was nobody around, and Junior started to crouch down and he got very quiet. He said come with me. So I started to follow him, and I could see other people. They were looking around in the forest. And I really started to get more curious than anything. I thought, well, what the heck are we looking for? Mm. Gnomes or fairies or gypsies or, you know, what's going on? And I realized that the people who were already there were in the old graveyard. There was an old graveyard that's out there that was abandoned. And Junior started looking around. And I said, Junior, what are we doing here? Mm. And he said, there was a midnight burial a while ago. And my heart stopped. I said, what do you mean a midnight burial? And he said, somebody in Smith, their son died of AIDS. And they didn't bury him in town. They buried him out here in this abandoned graveyard so that the family wouldn't come out which of the first of the Fort Smith families had lost a son to AIDS out of shame. And that's when I said, Junior, take me home. I don't want to have anything to do with this. Mm. I went into shock
yeah.
that that I'd come back to just this incredible sadness, and I really felt strongly for the family because living down south, I had AIDS is a reality. Yeah. HIV, Hep C is such a reality, but it was the first time in my hometown that AIDS had taken a life.
Mm-hmm.
And this family was the first of several now to lose people to AIDS. And there's a lot of shame in Indian country about AIDS. And in fact, right now...
Why? Because of homophobia?
Yeah, homophobia, and it's sexually related.
Yeah.
It's assumed
yeah, sure,
that it's sexually
sure,
related.
Sure.
So it's a taboo.
Mm.
And I just became so sad, and so that was it. He took me back to my house, and I didn't say anything to my family for a long time. And about a couple months later, a friend of mine, her name is Trika, she ended up owning a bar in Fort Smith, a pub called the Arctic Oasis, which is interesting because my brother Johnny and my dad Jack they bought that bar from her a year later after this happened. She called me one night and she said, I have a gift for you. And I said, oh, well, thank you. And she says, I've just finished cashing out. I'm just getting ready to go home. So let's meet for coffee tomorrow. But it'll cost you $20. And I thought, well, what kind of gift is that where you have to pay $20, right? So the next day we met at the little coffee shop in Fort Smith. And she said, well, where's that $20? I said, well, where's that gift? She says, you show me that $20 first. So I said, okay. So I gave her $20. Mm-hmm. And then she gave me a $20 bill back. And I said, okay. I don't get it. She said, turn that $20 bill over that I just gave you. And I did. And on the back of that $20 bill, in a red crayon, someone had written, my mother was cursed the day she bore me. I am faint with envy of the dead. And she said, you need to write a story about who wrote this and where they were when they wrote it. And then a couple nights later, I had a dream. And I had a dream about mermaids and men swimming across the ocean. And I could see men carving temples out of Chinese jade so that the mermaids could sit on them. And then I had one of the lasting images was the human men looking out over the ocean and seeing the mermen coming around the corner. And I could tell that the humans started to love them too. And then I woke up. And then probably a couple days after that, I got a call from CBC Radio, and they said that they were doing something called the Festival of Fiction. And the Festival of Fiction, I believe they found six senior authors, really established authors, to write a radio drama. And those six had to pick an emerging author for CBC to contact. Thomas King had written a radio drama, and he'd told CBC to contact me. So CBC called me and they said, Dr. Thomas King would like you to write a radio drama of your choice. You have, I believe they gave me 6 months, and we will air it, and you're allowed to pick whoever you want to narrate it. And the second they said that, I knew that I wanted to pick Ben Cardinal. Mm-hmm. Ben Cardinal is a very famous Cree actor here in Canada and in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I had met him when I was working on the set of North of 60. Mm-hmm. And I loved his voice. I say really clearly that he's got a year, it sounds like 20 years of cough drops and whiskey. This guy's got the perfect voice for Torchy. Yeah. And at that time, when I had land in a trailer in my hometown of Fort Smith, and that's where I wrote, and I lived, and I loved that little house so much. And there was a young girl named Stephanie who was usually either locked out of her house because her mother was drinking, or ended up coming over to my house so I would cook for her because she was starving, and it was really pitiful.
Yeah.
And I learned that from another friend of mine that her mother, when she found out was pregnant with Stephanie, had tried to kill Stephanie by drinking. She wanted to drink her baby to death. But Stephanie was born perfectly...
No fatal accident.
Well, I don't know, but she was born without, you know, a cleft palate. She was born without any physical symptoms of... anything that would be harmful. She's really
behavior. Is she very high?
As far as I know, she's fine. She's actually what they call a miracle baby. And Stephanie became, in her own quiet way, she became a little sister to me that I've never had, because I'm the oldest of four boys. And I really cared for Stephanie, and I just saw the absolute neglect, and I realized that in Fort Smith, there, in a lot of houses, there's always an extra place set for someone like Stephanie, where it's unspoken that she doesn't have a healthy meal waiting for her. She doesn't have a hot meal waiting for her at home. And that's always broken my heart. I hate elder abuse. I hate child abuse. I hate neglect. And so now that Mermaids is done, I'm turning it into a novel. And so I have Snowbird and I have Stephanie making a go of it as a family. And I'm very excited about it. I'm taking my time with it. But I'll tell you a little bit about Snowbird. When I was growing up in Fort Smith, I got to drive the handy bus, and I got that. It's a big bus that you drive people and elders all over town to go shopping, to bingo, to physiotherapy, and it was a great opportunity because that was where I met a lot of the elders who really took me under their wings, like Irene Sanderson and Maria Brown, Seraphine Evans, people who are just really instrumental in my life. Dora Taranjo, who just passed away at the age of 99 just a little while ago. Dora Taranjo. And I remember one time I was visiting Maria Brown, and she told me about a medicine man that she got to meet when she was very little, and his name was Snowbird, and that they said that he could call the wind with a $2 bill. And I never forgot that. I thought that that was the most incredible, just that one sentence alone. And he wasn't blind, but I knew that I wanted to have a medicine man that was blind. And I knew that I wanted somebody who was a pyromaniac, and I knew that I wanted somebody who was an abandoned little girl. And I knew that I really wanted to incorporate that scene in Fort Fitz where we were all looking to see who the first family was, and I knew I wanted to write about that midnight burial. So that was how I wrote Mermaids. Thank you.
Thank you. The West Coast and lived there was because there's more light. Seen together, I, Tony, and Almighty present an ambivalent and contradictory, almost schizoid but never boring composite character who is essentially fictional, inasmuch as every autobiographical I is never a one-to-one equation with the author's own self. Together they embody aspects of the author's identity which the author chose to share with the public. There are slippages between I and Tony and Almighty, and also between the various women characters, and these are stylistic expressions, I would say, of how closely the three stories are related and are a unity, are form an interface which is characteristic of its own, and they existed long in Howard's mind, long before we got the idea of sort of putting them together. The interface is a laboratory in which to examine and make conscious the effects of racism and colonialism on a meaty individual, which is ego and alter ego in itself simultaneously. And now come to the autobiographies as conscientization through writing. How it was immensely rooted in St. Louis, Saskatchewan, emotionally. His wife, Marge, said there was not one day when he didn't speak about the old place and the old farm. When he deals in his text with memories of his childhood, especially of his mother, and of the animals and the plants and the shape of the landscape in his home region, he almost gets elegiac, very romantic, sometimes very overwritten, and certainly he writes from the heart and not from the analytical mind of the political theorist, which he was, who he was. At the same time, he stresses emphatically that there is this love, but there's also a hatred, an immense hatred for the destitute situation under which he grew up. So when he thinks back home, there's a mix of fascination and love and longing, and also a hatred and rejection of the poverty. And this conflict of love and hate with regards to his home space, I think, remained unresolved until the end of his life. Although intellectually he could say, okay, these are my feelings for family and so on, and this is my hatred of the capitalist system. That remained. But he, as an individual, had to cope with both at the same time. Another thing, he enjoyed the limelight. He liked to be the revolutionary hero up front, and he would had a specific stance, you know, stand his legs like that, akimbo, and put his hand in the hip, and then he would go, and often his eyes would roll up, you know. But he had a fantastic speaking voice, you know, rolling thunder, grumbling, I can't do it. I've got this high white man voice, but it was a remarkable voice, a very attractive person, Howard, actually. an undated caricature by somebody called F. Kelly, maybe a student, that I found in the archives. It shows Howard in a fantasy uniform as a character somewhere between a Russian general, a duce, a Führer, and Fidel Castro. The name shift Tony Parker to Tony Bruce is consistent with the development of Tony's political career. At first, like Quanah Parker, he resisted, but then acquiesced, and he was a half-breed, and then wanted to become a successful businessman like Quanah Parker, the Comanche chief. And Bruce, I think, goes back to Robert the Bruce, the first Scottish king who fought a guerrilla warfare, it says today, against the English to win Scottish independence. And in the Tony novel, Tony Bruce is the guerrilla who moves amongst his people in the way that Mao Zedong described it for the revolutionary, the guerrilla revolutionary, to move amongst the people like the fish in the water. Most of the settlements had heard about Tony Bruce, so he was welcomed in each town or ghetto reserve. That says it. Howard's political convictions, as well as his activist strategies, were profoundly influenced by historical incidents that happened in the U.S. while he was at Berkeley. There was the beginning of the student movement. There was the end of the civil rights and the beginning of the Black Power movement, linked with the vanguard position of African Americans and Africans in the national liberation movements in the world, in Africa, in the Caribbean, but also in the U.S. And also he witnessed the beginning of the Chicano, Native American, and so on movements. But that was a very exciting time. And the person who influenced him most of all was Malcolm X, who was assassinated on February 21st, 1965, 2 years before Howard graduated. But Howard had heard Malcolm X speak at the Berkeley campus, and he was so impressed by that, and I read that quotation. It seems typical of Howard that after this turning around, this crisis in his life, he withdrew. He wanted to be by himself, and he went to a place where he was close to nature. That is Howard. Sometimes it was very hard doing this, because Howard was a very, very dear friend of mine. And every once in a while, he as a person comes up again, below all this editing and this almost formalistic stuff that I've been doing for eight months now, which is quite boring at times and very isolating, very lonely a task. But Howard comes through. So he went into nature to be by himself, to think. And he did the decisive step. He went back to the oral tradition, to his uncle Medrick, who was the oral historian, who was a socialist, who was a Catholic, who was an NDP member all his life and always active on behalf of Métis people. And he was the historian. Howard gained a solid understanding and analysis of the history of Métis people. He went to the archives. He had other people do research for him. So his identity, his strong, positive identity as Métis, is based on historical awareness. Now, much has been written about autobiographical writings by African Americans. And a contemporary of Howard's, Klaus Enslin in Germany, came up with three categories, political categories, of black autobiographies. The first one is focuses on the individual, and life is seen as a series of seemingly unrelated episodes in the individual's life, a string of coincidences, non-reflected occurrences, seemingly disconnected and totally independent of society. The second category is focuses also on the individual and shows the individual's life in the sense of the Franklin autobiography, from rags to riches, making the sort of American way pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and making a career that is a role model. Anybody can be that successful. That's the dream, that's the ideology. Anybody can do it if you work hard enough, which of course, I'm sorry, is bullshit. But and the third category is Anslin is a politicized autobiography where this focus is no longer on the individual as such, but the individual is seen as a representative of his group, his ethnic group, his class, and so on. And his life is seen as paradigmatic to analyze the structures of society that impede or accelerate his development, or her development, sorry. Now, Howard's Malcolm X's autobiography clearly is a politicized biography like that. So is Howard's book. So is Maria Campbell's book. And I would say to a large degree is also the non-fictional, but the autobiographically inspired novel In Search of Avril Raintree. I also see that in many ways as a very politicized and conscientized book. Now, there were a lot of other autobiographical texts coming out by Aboriginal writers in the 70s, and I won't go into them, but I just read the names. So Maria Campbell, Harold Cardinal, Minnie Audler Freeman, Elizabeth Gowdy, Alma Green, Emma LaRocque, Lee Marical, Mike Mountain Horse, Wilfred Pelletier, Peter Pitsiolak, Duke Redbird, Chief John Snow, John Tetzo, Anthony Apricot Thresher, Jane Willis. They all came out with texts, partly autobiographical or wholly autobiographical in the 70s. And a lot of them are quite political. And one thing they often stress is the conflicts, the existential contradictions of the Aboriginal person and the sort of centrifugal power that pull the individual away from the center, away from the community, into the mainstream world, you know, whirling them around, pushing them out, alienating them through schooling, through all kinds of forces, and the centripetal forces that pull them back in again for healing, for support, for love from back home. And this, these two forces that rage in the individual, I think are most poignantly and most beautifully expressed in this wonderful essay by Emma LaRocque. And again, the title, I think, is written for the love of words or for the love of alliterations, and I can fully identify with that. The beautiful article, Tides, Towns, and Trains. Howard's autobiographical writings reflect these processes. What distinguishes them from most others, but not all, is the high degree of political reflection and abstraction with which he explicates his individual experiences as the necessary results of internal colonialism. Now, in another scholar, Wolfgang Close, in his analysis of Campbell's and Cullerton's books, wrote in 1991, that the promotion of historical consciousness and the search for ethnic identity have become prime issues in contemporary Canadian Métis literature. He explores this ambivalence of love and hate in the I narrator, or Maria Campbell, and he says there's a certain formula. There's the original love, then comes fear, then comes shame and self-hatred, alienation from the own culture. He follows the same in Cheryl Raintree, and he says the confrontation with social prejudice, the adoption of alienated value structures, racial shame, and ethnic self-denial. And in both cases, these processes lead towards passing, towards denial. Passing, of course, is a strategy that that works within the contradictions of racism. Racism in itself, race in itself is totally insignificant. It's only significant in relation to racism as an ideology. And what does racism ideologize? It makes a linkage between class structure and visibility. This is putting it in a nutshell and maybe oversimplified. But I see racism as an ideology. And ideology here understood in the classical sense as false consciousness, a consciousness that sort of is put in place of analysis and enlightened explanation. Ideology sort of blurs our perception of the world by giving explanations that do not explain the radical root causes, but form theories around them which obscure an understanding. And I think that race in a class society obscures an understanding of class. Quote, if visible distinction coincides with class, passing becomes one variant of the mainstream theme of upward mobility of the American dream. Now, we should remember that, of course, passing does nothing to deconstruct racism. Quite on the contrary, in a way it uses racism for individual self-promotion, but it leaves the racist system totally intact. And could even be served to stabilize it, because you can always say, oh, he can make it, or she can make it, despite racism and despite class. Now, in Beatrice Culleton's In Search of April Raintree, we also learn something else about racism, namely the ambivalence, the ambiguity of racism as an ideology that classifies people into ethnic groups. The two sisters look totally different, yet they belong to the same ethnic group. So if race or visibility is such a such an insecure or ambivalent way of identifying ethnic identity, what is it then that allows Howard Adams and Beatrice Culleton and Maria Campbell to develop a positive and a lasting, not an ambivalent, but quite an explicit identity as a Métis person? And I think this is history, an understanding of history, a conscientization. And this is what Howard is all about. Maybe I'm rushing too much, but this conscientization process. If you think of Cheryl and April sending messages, historical messages, letters telling Cheryl, these are our people, this is what they did. It takes Cheryl a long time to understand that, yes, there is this positive thing about Métis-ness. In Maria, it's much clearer. She remembers her chichim and her teaching, and her chichim was related to Gabriel Dumont. And that proud history of resistance, tragic history perhaps. And the same, absolutely the same thing with Howard Adams. Going back to Medrick McDougall, the historian, who tells him, yes, Maxime Lépine, the guy who suffered 7 years in prison because he fought for his people. Those are the people we come from. So it is a type of identity that does not go via skin color, via blood. It goes through enlightenment, through history, and through place rather than race, and through history, through story rather than blood. Now it's interesting in this context to compare Howard's writings to the books, if we can and time-wise, of another Aboriginal writer who published two books in the recent years, and who made an astounding career in the diplomatic service for Canada, who came from extremely poor conditions, and through a stroke of luck, he was plucked from that and thrown into the mainstream, and he made it very successfully. Of course, I'm referring to James Bartleman, the Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, who published Out of Muskoka, that is his childhood and youth, how he got out of that in 2002, and then his successful book on Six Continents, Life in the Canadian Foreign Service, published this year. He was traumatized late in his life. He was robbed in South Africa in a hotel, and he had to beg for his life. and that made him think and stop about his life. He was so traumatized, he went back, he went to therapy, and then he started writing down his experiences as an Aboriginal person. And he discovered what he calls the therapeutic magic of the pen. And this is what April Raintree is about. This is also what Halfbreed is about, the therapeutic power of the pen, self-therapy, like a lot of women's writing. In he also says something, he writes about passing, and then he writes something like, "Half-breeds everywhere, I thought that I would always be an Aboriginal without a home, condemned to share Indian grievances against white society and to understand white attitudes to Indians." These words could have been written by Howard Adams, or I think by any quote-unquote half-breed person. And this because the ambivalence, because of the ambivalence of that being, and unless the identity is clearly grounded, the way I just explained, the way that Howard went through conscientization, going back to the stories, going back to the place, it's forever shifting, especially a racial biologized identity. For a half-breed person, it's immensely insecure. It took Chicana author Gloria Anzaldúa in her book Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, which has become the mixed blood Bible, if you like, to radically de- and reconstruct the perception of mestiza or metiness. And I leave out the gender aspect now, the sexual orientation aspect, the linguistic aspect, the religious aspects, all those are dealt with in that fantastic book. Which some people say essentializes. Yes, it's a pioneering study. Anyway, that's another discussion. Anyway, but the she shows that middle position, that from liminality, that borderlands position is not a deficiency or a weakness, but should really be and is, and I've always seen it that way, an asset, because of that understanding Bartleman says, to understand the Indian grievances against whites and to understand the attitudes of whites against Indians. That is an insightful position, but it's a painful and uncomfortable one. I think there's even more to say about Métis identity and Howard's... We talked about the unique identity, the historical and local identity of Métisness, the positive identity that enables Howard and I think Beatrice Skeleton and Maria Campbell and many others to develop a positive Métis identity. And Howard's model overcomes racist essentialism and moves on to identify and criticize colonialism and class structures as forces that are incompatible with his humanist ideals and the way of life that we all deserve. And for a definition of this life that we all deserve, I'd like to quote Jeanette Armstrong, who once said, "Our humaneness, our compassion, our love, and how we need to rebuild that, because we all deserve the happiness, the joy, and the cleanness, and the purity. We all deserve that." While politically developing an internationalist perspective bent on decolonization, the class struggle, and the deconstruction of capitalism, which he identified as the root cause of all social evils, Howard Adams remained at the same time a half-breed with strong emotional ties to his birthplace, family, and stories, and a sterling knowledge of Métis history. This was the strength of Howard Adams' enlightened and politicized ethnic identity. Thank you very much. In both life stories, the adoption of the values and ideals of the dominant white culture and ruling class lead to painful denial of Aboriginal identity that results in passing. And here I'd like to add a few things about passing. Passing, of course, is a strategy that is based on and reacts to racist assumptions about the value of people according to visible ethnic traits. In other words, the way in which biology, descent, or blood are ideologized. But in and of itself, race makes no sense. Without racism, race would become obsolete. The problem is racism as a ruling ideology, as manifest both in structural and personal forms of racist violence. The problem is how racism ideologizes visible traits that are insignificant in and of themselves as markers of our social, intellectual, psychological, and spiritual humanity, such as the physical condition of having certain hair textures, flat asses, skin colors, or hairy bodies. The problem is the ideology of race, and ideology here is understood in, I think this is the Marxist understanding, as false consciousness. In other words, a consciousness that produces a false image of reality and blocks our understanding of reality and gives us a surrogate ideology or an explanation that hinders or blocks our understanding of the real structure. If visible distinction coincides with class, passing becomes one variant of the mainstream theme of upward mobility of the American dream. And this is exactly what Tony does and what Howard did for a time too. Tony tries to pass. While passing seems to be an option for individuals whose visibility does not fix them into the mold of the colonized, and allows them to transgress the class distinctions demarcated by visibility, their ethnic self-denial and self-hate exact a price on them, which would eventually destroy their ability to function as successful members of the white middle-class world, be it through substance abuse or clinical depression. This is what the text show. Let us not forget, however, that passing does nothing to abolish racism or change the class structure. Far from it. By adopting alienated value structures, as Close says, the passing person reacts individually to the ideological